This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how are you this afternoon? Great to have you along. This hour, a group of demersal fishermen who can no longer fish along a 900-kilometre stretch of the coast has hired a legal firm to negotiate on their behalf for compensation from the state government. Phil DeGraw says he and the other fishers have hired a lawyer because they have no confidence in the government's compensation calculations. We'll catch up with Phil shortly. Also today, a team from Western Australia has taken top honours at the Supreme Australian Working Sheepdog Championships being held in Queensland this week. Six past 12 on the ABC WA. We'll start today with a look at the weather because this slow-moving front making its way across the state's southwest land division is delivering some much-needed rain to parts of the agricultural region today. Curious to know if it's happening at your place. Are you getting the rain that you need? Let me know on the text 0448 922604. Would love to hear from you this afternoon. Scott Crosby farms near Nyabing, 320 kilometres southeast of Perth. He couldn't be happier today, enjoying the sound of rain on the shed's tin roof.
I could listen to it all day. Hopefully we do.
How much have you had so far?
Till 7 o'clock this morning we'd had 25 mils and I'm guessing we've had about 5 since. But, yeah, I haven't gone and had a look at the gauge since then. So, yeah, between 4 and 5 is a guess. Don't think near much more than that.
Oh, no, it's been drier this way. Have you been really sweating on this?
Well, there's been a few forecasts over the last, say, month. And, yeah, this is the first one to really come through. Yeah, sweating on it, I guess, and concerned, but nothing we can do about it, just doing the best we can.
Last listed you here back in May, and at that stage there you were, you know, obviously concerned about the season, saying it could be quite risky. But how's it panned out since then?
Well, we had a good June, and so that gives us a bit of confidence, but we had the driest July on record by 12.5 mils, so we only had 12 mils. And before that was, I think it was 2010, I think, where we only had 25 mils. So it's, you know, it was extremely dry. So August was okay so far. This is great now. So we're going to be up around 40, 50 mils for August now. So, yeah, that's average, I guess. Anything more than that would be a bonus.
Have you looked into the looking glass for the future? Do you see what might be coming?
No, I don't really worry about it. I can tell you it's wet at the moment because it's raining. That's about as good a forecast as we've got. So, yeah, look, you know, the long range stuff is probably drier, is what they say, then wetter come the end of October, but who knows? I think that we have that many variables in our life and in the weather systems that, you know, you might be in the right spot, you might be in the wrong spot.
Because it's been quite a dry sort of patch right from east, you know, Noongar up right the way through, but you managed to dodge some of that? Or?
Oh, no, we're probably right in that, and we've had a couple of cold nights as well. So, yeah, no, we're right in the middle of that. But, yeah, it's all right. Like, it's farming. Can't do much about it.
Just looking at the radar, there's quite an unusual system in that it looks like it's sort of swirling around and staying right above you.
Yeah, well, it looks like we're right on the edge, so it's a bit more to the east of me, where the bulk of it is at the moment. But, yeah, it seems to be getting fed from the south coast at the moment. So they did talk about potential of a southeasterly rain on the country yesterday with the Weather Bureau, and looks like it's going to happen. We might be on the edge here getting more. We might not be. So far, so good. If this can hang around till dark, well, it'll be at least another 5 mils. So, you know, to be well over 30 mils for the rain event's perfect.
So far, all of your seeding has survived so far quite well?
Oh, yeah. You know, so it's all come up. It's all there. Yeah, look, it was starting to thin out, starting to, you know, really say, well, we need to get a boogie on and put a head out and try and do the reproduction phase. So this will hopefully slow it down a little bit. But, yeah, no, it was all there. Its potential's there. We just needed a decent rain event, and well, any rain in August is good, so we'll take that.
Scott Crosby enjoying the rain at his farm in Nibing and speaking to Mark Bennett in the farm shed, listening to the rain coming down on the roof. I hope it's happening at your place. If it is, let me know. 0448 922 604. Text through, let me know where you are and where the rain is falling. Bonnet has just texted in from Dumbleyung, 36 mils in the gauge. Thank you for that. 0448 922 604. We'll cross to the Bureau and see where that front is, where the rain is being delivered. And, of course, Richard going through the rainfall figures in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, just after 12:30 also. There's a bit to get through. 12:10 here on the Country Hour. A group of demersal fishermen who can no longer fish along a 900-kilometre stretch of coast has hired a legal firm to negotiate on their behalf for compensation from the state government. Just before Christmas, Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis gave the fishermen 4 weeks' notice that they were to be permanently banned from fishing in the West Coast Zone, which stretches from Kalbarri to Augusta. The minister also announced $20 million in compensation for displaced fishers, but most are yet to see any money. Kalbarri-based fisher Phil DeGraw says he and the other fishers hired a lawyer because they have no confidence in the government's compensation calculations.
We're at the stage now that individual fishers are now meeting representatives of the department to determine what they might receive in compensation. Some licence holders have already been paid out solely based on their licence value, and that's a minority. There's a group, a large group, of which I'm part of. We've decided to engage a lawyer, so we've got a class action. And there's another smaller group that have decided to go it alone and negotiate with the department on their own terms.
Why did you decide to go down the path of engaging a lawyer?
Well, we weren't confident with, one, the approach, the consultation process or anything. And we received absolutely no information on how that compensation package might work. The only thing we did know is that they based it on a certain value, which was based on the buyback 2 years ago. But it took 2 months for the department to actually accept that that's what the value of the licence was going to be. So we had no confidence that we were going to get a good outcome.
Do you have any clarity yourself and the majority of the industry? Do you have any clarity about what you may be entitled to when it comes to like a dollar figure?
Well, it's still very unclear what that dollar figure is. I know of one individual fisher who chose to do the negotiations himself, was in first on the list and has now completed the negotiations, but he's not allowed to disclose what that figure might be. That was only finalised last week, I think.
Why is it so complicated?
Some fishers have been in the industry a long time. I've been in the industry over 40 years. Other fishers have got processing businesses based upon their catch, and those catches might be smaller, but they're no less important to others that are larger. We also got a cross-section of members and licence holders that are either leasing and dependent on a lease for some income, and they might be retired fishermen. And then we've got fishers, like most of the active fishers, were all having to lease more entitlement. And that was because we got multiple cuts over multiple years.
And when you lease the entitlement, there's no compensation associated with that.
That's true, yes.
So really it's about pointing out that it's the immediate impact, but it's also the flow-on effect for every person. And for every person, that sounds like it's different.
It is. So we can't pigeonhole every end of fisher because we're all totally different. Because we're talking about the West Coast, we've got guys who fish solely to catch mainly jewfish. Or in the South Coast, they'll get the deep water red snapper. There's a real mix of different types of fishing and the size of the boats, the scale, and every different little bit and pieces that puts together what is the wetline fleet.
When do you think you might see some sort of outcome and you receive a share of the $20 million that the government has earmarked for compensation?
Really not sure at all. As I said, we heard one guy has reached settlement. But I've talked to others who have received 3 emails since Christmas, and we're already well behind. So I'm assuming this is going to be continue all year. Beginning of August was the planned date that we would arrive at settlement. I can't see us being, all of those fishers, been getting any money for another 3 months.
Is that a frustrating wait, 8 months on?
Well, it's a pretty long wait if you're not being able to fish at all. A lot of guys have moved on. There's a few that are relying on that money and really want to settle it. It's a difficult situation, and we're not getting good, clear feedback. We've been drip-fed. The whole process has been drip-fed. A lot of questions been asked, not many been answered. It's just a bitterness the way the whole thing was set up, no consultation, and now we've had to fight tooth and nail now to get the correct compensation. As I said, we're hoping that it's more on track, and that's why we have confidence that's why we brought in the lawyers and employed to do their job.
Kalbarri-based fisher Phil de Graw speaking to Joe Prendergast. Phil can still fish in the Gascoyne as he is licensed across both zones. 16 past 12. While most fishers are just beginning the negotiation process for compensation, former Dongara-based fisher James Oliver has no chance of seeing any money. Despite investing tens of thousands of dollars into setting up a wet line fishing business, he leased the fishing units. He didn't own them, so he's not entitled to a share of the state government's $20 million compensation package. He says he loves fishing, and in hindsight, he'd do it all again.
I was working on the back of cray baits for years. We had trouble sending them to China. I was getting a bit older and it was time to move on. So I got an idea to buy a wet liner and went out and had a go myself.
So always been fishing, decided this was the impetus to start your own fishing
business.
Yeah,
just have a crack at it. Thought I'd go and have a go, yeah.
Yeah. What was that like to get into a new industry?
It was hard. I had some good support from older fishermen around here. I had a lot of support. It was really good to see. I started off share fishing for the first couple of years and had a crack at that. And then after that, I went out on my own and leased units.
What was the structure of your business? You leased units that allowed you to fish.
That's right.
What did you invest in?
I went into a cheaper boat to start with, which I'm pleased. If I'd overcapitalised, I would have been in big trouble. But, you know, I was looking at $33,000 a year in lease, ongoing mooring fees, dinghy pen fees, shed fees. You know, it all adds up. And all the gear that goes wrong with it.
So you bought a boat, you made all those other...
I outlaid everything.
Very similar to any fishing business, except you didn't own the units.
I didn't own
the units. You were leasing them.
Yeah, 100% lease. Of three different people. So they were investors.
How was it going? You were doing it for a few years.
It was going good. It was tough to start with, but things were going really well. All the fish went local, straight up to Geraldton. So a guy out there, and they got distributed through Geraldton, through the restaurants and through the public. Joke, right? He did what he wanted to do with them, but it was all local.
And like any small business, really, when you start softly, you return money back into the business.
That's right.
Were you setting yourself up with freezers, ice,
all that
stuff?
Yeah, it took time. It took sort of 5 years to get where I was and 5 minutes for it to be taken away.
Government made those announcements to changes to demersal fishing.
That's right.
At the beginning of December last year.
That's right.
How did you find out about that?
I was out fishing at the time, and when I got into range, I got a text from a friend, and that was on the 3rd of December, and the 31st of December was our last fishing day.
Did you know this was coming?
No idea. We knew that they were in talks, but not about us. We'd already taken a lot of hits. We'd already taken rot, so this was out of the blue.
What compensation have you been entitled to with your business being shut down?
Nothing, because I lease. So the unit holders who own the units are entitled to compensation, and good on them, so they should be. I know that they'd rather be fishing. I know that for a fact, and I'm 100% supportive. But as a person that leases, nothing.
And the people that you lease your units of, with some of them investors, people who don't own
100%.
Boats?
One out of the two owned a boat, but not in this region. They were investors. One was overseas, one was a businessman, and another one was a fisherman.
So any compensation for that unit no longer going to sea will go to them and not to you.
Yeah. And to be honest, Joe, so should they own it? But then it's not on them to take this brunt. You know, the government has shut us down. We pay huge amounts in lease a year, which they get a percentage off, fisheries and deep herding and what have you, to go towards research.
The fact that you would not receive compensation, you would not receive an act of grace claimant because you leased,
yeah.
That was raised to government.
through Parliament.
Yep.
What was the response to that?
You saw the email. They pretty much put it back on us that we leased into an unsustainable fishery and that it was up to us, the risk that we took, and between us and the people that own the units to sort it out. I never thought it was unsustainable. I got 3 weeks' notice. It's the best fishing year I'd ever had.
When you sat and sort of, I guess, it would have taken a bit to process, I imagine, that the decision that was made, the reality for you.
Yeah.
What did you have to do?
Backtrack real quick. So I had 3 weeks' notice. So like I said, 31st was our last fishing day. Come January 1st, that was it. And then you're stuck with ongoing bills. You're stuck with a boat on moorings. You're stuck with public liability insurance, a deckie without a job, ongoing payments and sheds, and that with a boat that's making no money. So I went and got outside work and paid for those bills.
And you had to sell everything you could?
Yeah.
Quickly?
Quickly.
I imagine if you look at your life 12 months ago versus now, it's vastly different.
It is. It is. I went up to Darwin to do some fishing, actually. I wanted to continue fishing and there's nothing here. It's what I love to do. So I left, went to Northern Territory and had a crack up there.
And how's that going?
It's going okay.
Yeah. So you're just in and out of Darwin, between Darwin and Dongara now?
At the moment, yeah. Yeah.
How does it all sit with you, James, that government did this?
To be honest with you, Jay, like, I just don't want this happening again or happening to anyone who really wants to have a crack, just the small fella, you know. I'm out. So no matter if this gets turned around, there's no coming back. Boats are gone, moorings are gone, everything's gone. And I, you know, it is what it is. I just don't want it to happen again. Especially to a guy that just wants to have a go, some young guy or in any industry. 3 weeks' notice for a government that's meant to look after you. Like, you can make these decisions, and if she stands by it and she thinks it's the right thing to do, well, so be it. But morally, it was all wrong. We had no talks. We had no sit-downs with her. Nothing. Didn't hear from her.
When you look at the flow and effects of that decision, what about the consumer? Where was your fish going?
All to Geraldton. So it was all local. You brought us fresh up in Geraldton. And we could distribute it through Geraldton to the public, to restaurants, fish and chip shops. Yeah.
And that's no longer there.
That's no longer there.
Were you pretty proud of that?
I was really proud. Yeah. I was pretty stoked every time I went up there. You know, it was all local, it was all fresh, it was all looked after, and it was a good feeling.
You sold the boat for you, there's no going back to
fishing. No, so I'm getting nothing out of this. I just don't want this to happen again to anyone.
And with selling the boat,
yeah.
How has that left you from a tax perspective?
I owe money on sale.
So you've now been left with a tax bill because you had to sell a boat that you couldn't use.
Yeah, and that I didn't want to sell. But 3 weeks' notice.
Is there a bit of salt in the wound?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
No. I was lucky, Joe, I sold the boat. I mean, I know people down south, I think, that are stuck with it. And if I was stuck with it, it would have been an ongoing concern, you know? So that's bittersweet.
Mm. And I guess the whole point is, It was a long process to build up your business. It's not something that you can shut down and walk away from and not lose money over 3 weeks.
Sure. And it was my, you know, I put my own money into it. It was my investment, my money. There's no family money or anything. It was hard grit that got there. 100%. Had a crack. Was doing all right. 3 weeks, you're out.
If you were to wind the clock back 5 years, would you have started fishing here in Dongara?
100%.
Why?
It's what I love to do. I made it work. I wasn't the one that failed it. I wasn't the one that gave myself 3 weeks' notice. It was working. I'd do it all again.
You missed it?
Yeah, I do.
Former Dongara-based fisher James Oliver speaking to Joe Prendergast. And if you want to read more about it, Joe's put up an online story for you. Just go to the ABC Rural homepage, so search ABC Rural, that'll take you there and you can read through Joe's online story. 12:24, we'll get to the news headlines shortly.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Just before those news headlines, a team from WA has taken top honours at the Supreme Australian Working Sheepdog Championships being held in Queensland this week. The team, including Grant Cook, Gordon Curtis and Simon Leaning, won the Interstate Challenge, taking home the Ted Gaby Shield. Grant Cook, a farmer from Northam, also achieved the highest score of the competition, earning himself a spot on the national Australian team to compete against New Zealand. As you can imagine, he's thrilled with the result.
I suppose with any competition, Kate, there's a little bit of luck that goes a long way. I'm absolutely honoured to be able to represent my state firstly, along with the other guys, and then to have gone on and earned a spot in the Australian side. It's the pinnacle of our sport, Kate, and very close to the ag industry, ag and stock industry. So, yeah, no, it's a great honour and privilege.
And this is the first time WA has won the Ted Gaby Shield in quite a while, I'm right in saying.
Correct. We last won that shield in 2008. So it's highly competitive, and obviously you need a bit of luck. You're a country girl, Kate. You know what it's like with a minimum amount of sheep. If you can imagine three cranky sheep, one dog and a person and five lines and trying to go around a designated course and achieve things on the way, it's not easy.
I was going to say, maybe a couple of swear words thrown around.
definitely, what's the word, the sheep yard language.
Yeah, we won't go there. And going forward now, what happens? Because not only have you taken out the Ted Gaby Shield, you also have won another competition.
I've won the right to go into the Australian team. The top four from that competition earn that right. And then the New Zealanders come into Stanthorpe this afternoon. Then they have a look around for a couple of days, and then we compete against them over a three-test series on Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Well, the competition this week is being held in Queensland, so you travelled over there to compete.
That's correct. We left, I'm not sure what the date was actually now, but we've been on the road for a fortnight this Friday. We set off from home, and we competed in Wagen at our state championships and saw some of the driest areas in our state, from home to Wagen, and then Wagen going out through Dumbleyung and on out to Lake King, down to Gibson, Norseman, across the Nullarbor.
And you yourself, you run a mixed cropping and sheep farm near Northam. How are things going for you up there at the moment? I mean, I know you're away as we speak, but what's it been like?
So we're very dry. We've had approximately 185 millimetres for the year to date, and we are at the cusp, and we're hoping this front that's approaching WA is going to be of huge benefit to us, and it will be the turning point in our season if we get a decent rain.
And there is some rain falling across the state, or the agricultural area anyway. We'll get the details on that shortly. Northam farmer Grant Cook speaking to Kate Forrester. Grant is one of three competitors from WA who have been awarded that Ted Gaby Shield at the Supreme Australian Working Sheepdog Championships being held in Queensland this week. As I mentioned, Grant now goes on to compete for Australia. After achieving the highest score in the competition, he's been involved in sheepdog trials for around 30 years and is the current president of the WA Working Sheepdog Association. Well done. 28 past 12, Jonathan Hopper in the studio with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong says at least 34 Australians are missing after a devastating landslide and flash flood in the Himalayan border region. Nepalese authorities say more than 150 people have been confirmed dead so far, but that number is expected to rise significantly. One of Australia's biggest retail groups, Wesfarmers, has announced an 8.3% jump in full-year after-tax profit. The parent company of Bunnings, Kmart and Officeworks recorded $47.27 billion in revenue for the 12 months to June, with an after-tax profit of $2.87 billion. And a South West Shire will investigate methods to protect its forests amid reports of people illegally gathering firewood. The Shire of Donnybrook, Baillingup, supported the move yesterday after a report to council noted an increase in firewood being taken from non-designated collection areas. Thank you, Belinda.
Jonathan, thank you very much for that update. It's 29 past 12, and we'll go through the rainfall figures for the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning shortly. There's a bit to get through, but in the meantime, we're just checking if you have had some rain, and Paul certainly has. 54 millimetres and still raining in Kellerberrin. Absolutely amazing. I hope it's raining in the areas that need it most in the Great Southern. Thank you for reporting in, Paul. Appreciate that. Jim says, following on from my prayer 3 weeks ago, I'm blessing the Lord. Wonderful, says Jim. And this too from JP, was supposed to rain all day in Kalgoorlie, hasn't rained at all. 0448 922 604 if you'd like to text through and share the story at your place. Shortly we'll get an update on the bird flu situation in Australia, and then it's off to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle sale just before the news at 1. First, to the Bureau of Meteorology, Angeline Prasad with you this afternoon. And we'll get into the situation in the Southwest Land Division shortly. First, a quick look at what's happening across northern and eastern parts of the state.
Good afternoon, Belle. Yes, it is getting quite warm across the north of the state. There is a patchy cloud band that is extending across parts of the north, across the western Kimberley, into the northern parts of the interior and into the Gascoyne. This cloud band will linger for a couple of days today into tomorrow before starting to contract further south on Saturday into Sunday, but it might produce the odd isolated shower and even maybe the odd thunderstorm, but I'm not expecting any you know significant rainfall. Is just a patchy cloud band that's just hanging around parts of the northern parts of the state. Now there is a trough that is going to move into the Goldfields and the Eucla with an associated low pressure system from the west this afternoon into evening, and much of that tropical connection to the northern of WA will mean that a lot of moisture will linger across the Goldfields and the Eucla and the southern interior for a few days. This cloud band thickens for the remainder of today until probably Sunday at this stage. We're expecting isolated thunderstorms in this cloud band. In terms of rainfall, the Goldfields and the Eucla and the southern interior can expect not much rainfall today. It's going to be pretty isolated, maybe just a couple of millimetres through these areas I have mentioned. But from tomorrow, as that trough and low pressure system becomes slow moving for Friday, Saturday, we will see 5 to 10 millimetres of rainfall, potentially getting isolated 10 to 20, and they could be very isolated 20 to 30 millimetres on both Friday and Saturday. The thunderstorms are likely to linger into Sunday, but the trough does become mobile and shifts further westwards. There's a risk of severe thunderstorms across the far eastern parts of the Goldfields and also the Eucla and the southern interior tomorrow. But today, with that trough moving closer to the Goldfields area, the southern parts of the Goldfields, basically the area south of about Norseman, might experience one or two heavy. It's just a very sliver of, far southern sliver of the Goldfields that might experience heavy falls this afternoon, evening. Rainfall totals in 10 to 20, maybe getting up to 30 millimetres in that area.
Ange, let's move into the Southwest Land Division. We've already heard from a few people who are pretty happy with the rain at their place. Is there any more on the way for any part of the Southwest Land Division?
Yes. So we've had some record rainfall. So a few places have seen their daily record rainfall for the month of August. So Minston Park, Gundadin, Dungin Peak, Hopetoun and Nattering are some of the locations they've had the highest daily rainfall for the month of August since records began in this area. For the remainder of today, as that trough very slowly moves eastwards into the Goldfields and the Eucla region, we'll continue to see this persistent rainfall. There is embedded thunderstorm activity in this cloud band as well. So for the remainder of today, the area bounded by Narrogin, Maradin, Beacon, Belladonna, down to Esperance to Jerramunga, we can expect another 10 to 20 millimetres. There could be isolated falls to 30 millimetres. Now within this area, there is a severe weather warning current, and that's currently still sort of extending east of Hopetoun, north of Hopetoun, east of Ravensthorpe, to the area west of Esperance. later this afternoon or during this afternoon evening period, it is possible that we may see one or two embedded thunderstorms develop, basically the area from Meridian all the way down to about Norseman. It's possible we may see a few more heavy falls in that area, sort of more in the 20 to 30 millimeters. It's hard to predict where exactly it'll happen, but that persistent rain that we're seeing through the eastern parts of the Great Southern and the southeastern parts of the Central Reed Bed are likely to persist for the remainder of the afternoon into the evening period before slowly easing. For the remainder of today, across the rest of the Great Southern and the Central Reed Belt, so basically the western areas, it's going to be just light rainfall, 1 to 3 millimeters, so nothing much. The heaviest falls will be concentrated on the eastern parts. Now tomorrow, the moderate falls are likely to contract east of Southern Cross to Ravensthorpe. So these areas, especially through the Esperance region, will continue to see 5 to 10 millimeters, isolated falls 10 to 20 millimeters, with only lighter showers or drizzle patches remaining through much of the Great Southern and Central Reed Belt. Now, as mentioned before, on Saturday and Sunday, the trough that moves further east does become mobile and actually shifts back over the Southwest Land Division, and it's likely that we'll see some renewed rainfall in the area east of Meriden to Ravensthorpe on Saturday before the rainfall eases. So there is more rainfall over the next few days. Now, in terms of frost, not likely to see frost areas over the next few days. It's really after the next cold front on Monday that we'll see frost patches return to parts of the Southwest Land Division. But over the weekend, we'll see extensive fog patches return. Returning to the temperatures today, it's quite cloudy. There's a persistent southeasterly flow, so it's quite cool underneath the cloud band. So we're going to see quite cold daytime temperatures across much of the Great Southern and the Central Reed Belt.
Ange, thanks for going through those details this afternoon. It's 23 to 1. This text just in saying that there's been 10 mils at Canna, a bit more would be nice. I hope it comes your way. Richard Hudson in the studio now to look back at the rainfall figures for the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, and starting up in the north, in the Kimberley, a little bit of rain. Derby had 10 mils and Derby Main Roads 5. And nothing in the Pilbara, nothing really worth mentioning in the Gascoyne. I think the most was 4 mils. Nothing in the interior or the goldfields, the Eucla districts, and nothing out on the islands. But in the Southwest Land Division, a fair bit. In the central west, it's 20 and above to give you an indication of how much rain fell. Alanuka had 38, Arena 25, Arrowdale 26, Badgingarra 27, Eneabba 38, Eridu 23, Arangi Springs also had 23. Geraldton 32, Greengrove 33, Irwin House 35, Durian Bay 34, Mingenew 20, Port Denison 48, Strawberry 33, Tabletop 31, Tibraden 30, and Warradarge East had 29. In the lower west, Anketell 25, Bickley 21, Bindoon also had 21, Bolgart 26, Dwelling Up 42, Garden Island had 53, Gidgegan up 26, Gingin West 32, Gleneagle 28, Jandakot 25, Jarrodale 22, Carnot 23, Carrigulla North 24, Lake Chittering 20, Mandurah 28, Millenden 35, Minston Park 44, Moolyabinnie 27, Moondah Brook 30, Mushay 21, Mundaring 31, Pinjarra 33, Wanneroo 25, Waroona 26, Werribee 20, and Whiteman Park had 23. Then in the southwest, Bailing up 20, Ferguson Valley 22, Harvey 32, McAlinden 20, Mount William 22, Mile up 28, and Worsley Downs had 21. Bit less in the southern coastal area, so it's 10 and above. Albany had 14, Amalup 18, Bremer Bay 29, Chain Beach 24, Chillon up 12, Denbarker 14, Gardner 26, Nowanga up 18, Hopetoun North had 53, Ingleburn 11, Jacob 16, Jerramungup 19, King River 14, Many Peaks 35, Mount Barker 18, Nyarill up 22, Ongar up 18, Stirlings North 14, Stirling South 28, Warrajarra 19, and Wellstead had 15. A bit more in the central wheat belt, but it was hit and miss. It'll be 20 and above, but that doesn't mean everywhere got decent rain. Ardeth had 36, Babbican 20, Belka East 60, Beverley had 31, Kalgeon Kowkowing 20, Kodgkodgen 28, Cunderdon 29, Doongan Peak 44, East Beverley 31, Kellerberrin 43, but just next to it alphabetically is Killarney that only had 5. That's to give you an indication of the hit and miss nature of it. Meckering North 31, Mount Hardy 26, Mount Noddy 24, Muresk 28, Northam 20, Quadney 22, Tammin and Yangadine 23, Whale recorded 29, Nattering 48, York 27 and York Rakine 30. Then in the Great Southern it's still 20 and above, Boddington North 23, Burralee and Boscobel 21, Cordering and Cranbrook 25, Culford 21, Dumbleyung 35, Highbury East 23, Queeta 20, Maradong 35, Narrogin 20, Nyabing and Quailup had 21, Wagen 25, Wandering 35, Wickapen South 26, Wilgarra 25 and Williams had 30. But as I say, not a comprehensive list, but if we had read it out comprehensively, we'd be here till 2 p.m.
Richard, thank you for going through those figures for us. It is 19 minutes to 1 o'clock. We'll head to Mount Barker just before the news at 1 to get the details of the cattle sale. An extra $125 million will be made available to help Australia cope with the impacts of bird flu. Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins made the announcement this morning. She says the extra funding will help with more surveillance and response activities.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Right. Yep. Good morning, everyone. As you would be aware, yesterday National Cabinet was briefed by Australia's Chief Veterinary Officer, Dr. Beth Cookson, in relation to the H5 bird flu and how it's making its way across the country and the national response from all of our governments. Across the country, the latest figures indicate there have been 330 positive events. There have been over 29,000 calls to our national hotline. In South Australia, we currently have 195 events, in Victoria 100, New South Wales 13, Tasmania 10, Western Australia 10, and Queensland has 2. With the spread of the H5 bird flu across the country, our government is doing everything we can to help protect Australia's wildlife wherever possible, to protect our agricultural industries wherever possible, our communities and our economy from the effects of the H5 bird flu. That's why, following National Cabinet, our government has committed further funding to continue safeguarding the country against the impacts of the H5 bird flu. This will bring our government's total investment in terms of the bird flu response to more than $270 million. The additional $125 million will be made available from the Commonwealth to support immediate actions through the National Emergency Biosecurity Response for the H5 bird flu. These activities will include vital surveillance, early detection, on-ground response capability, targeted initiatives for priority threatened species and conservation, as well as local community engagement. These activities are cost-shared equally by the Commonwealth, the states and the territories. The Commonwealth will also fund a further $20 million to boost and extend the on-ground action for key native species and locations, emergency response activities for native wildlife, including Commonwealth managed national parks, and supporting citizen science work. My colleague, Minister Watt, will also be seeking match contributions from states and territories for this new funding. It builds on the work that we've already undertaken over the several years by our government, working with wildlife experts, with industry, and with the states and territories in preparing us for the H5 bird flu. I do want to reiterate that at this stage there's no evidence of any infection in our poultry or agriculture systems and that the risk to human health remains low.
How concerned is the government about bird flu spreading into scavenging animals, and is there a plan in that space?
Yeah, I think all Australians are, you know, becoming concerned about what they see in terms of the amount of birds and wildlife being impacted. But I would say this is sadly as expected. Whilst it is very concerning, it's not unexpected what we are seeing as this H5 bird flu does make its way across the country. And we have been upfront with the Australian people. We understand this can be distressing, but we are going to see More sick and dead birds and other wildlife mammals particularly are being impacted by the H5 bird flu as it does make its way across the country.
You mentioned earlier that it's spread to other mammals. Is that more seals?
So we have two confirmed cases, I understand, in South Australia into seals. And obviously now we have the suspected positive case in relation to the fox in South Australia. So that is obviously, the samples from that have gone to the Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness, the CSIRO lab.
Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins addressing the media this morning about an extra $125 million being made available to help the whole of Australia cope with bird flu. 12:45. You just heard the minister mention foxes, and that's because a fox recently found in Adelaide is suspected to have died from H5 bird flu. If that's confirmed in the tests, it will be the first land-based animal to be infected with the disease in Australia. Michael Ward is chair of veterinary public health at the Sydney Vet School. He says it's a concerning development for the poultry industry and even for inland livestock farmers.
Yeah, well, the reason would be this is the first terrestrial mammal, I guess, we've detected with H5 if the results come back as positive from the Geelong laboratory. And I guess foxes are widely distributed. So if it's in the fox population, that would really spread the disease long distances.
Are you concerned about maybe the disease now crossing into different animals that we haven't really seen? I mean, where I am based, Michael, in the Eyre Peninsula, foxes are known to predate on lambs. So could that be an issue then now for livestock owners?
Yeah, exactly. So it's moving it from that very coastal interface now inland to different, you know, species, particularly as you say, sheep, I mean, cattle. Another issue, I suppose, you know, foxes and chickens, of course, you know, foxes are attracted to poultry. So we're really concerned about this spilling over into poultry. So foxes would be an ideal bridge species, which, you know, we don't have poultry production on the coast. So this is that link that's just being created, I guess. But, you know, like foxes could contaminate an environment, and if the temperature is right and there's enough water around, you know, the virus can persist. So it could create a environmental reservoir as well.
Mm, so what are you thinking, that the foxes also go into the drinking water when it's infected with the bird flu and it passes that way? I mean,
exactly. That's possible. You know, a bird dies in a water body, that can contaminate the water body for at least several days, if not weeks, depending on the temperature. And then, yeah, you can get other wildlife being infected. So that maybe is what happened, or it could be just direct. I mean, if a fox is scavenging off a carcass or even a live bird, that's the other, you know, transmission pathway.
And I guess thinking about the potential then for the bird flu-infected fox to infect livestock, how might that happen?
Yeah, I mean, it could happen. I mean, I suppose just sort of contact, or if it is contamination of the environment. One thing with foxes would be, I guess, you know, scavenging and dragging carcasses around, and then you've got, you know, contamination going on potentially on the pasture. You know, all these are possible. We don't really know. They're all possible pathways. In reality, we don't know. The thing is with foxes, they're just so widespread that if it's in the fox population, you'd expect it to, you know, move inland and move in, you know, wherever foxes are, you'll get H5, at least in the fox population. And that just creates that spillover scenario for other species. It's really quite surprising that, you know, up till now, I mean, every time it's been one worse thing after the other, but it was still sort of very coastal. It's sort of like marine mammals, it's seabirds, it's all along the coast, beaches. That's one thing. But then, I mean, foxes can just, we know where they are, you know, how far inland they are. It's almost a perfect way to sort of spread the disease very quickly over a wide distance.
Chair of Veterinary Public Health at the Sydney Vet School, Michael Ward, speaking to Janae Madden about a red fox that was recently found dead at Osborne, about 20 kilometres northwest of Adelaide. Testing is still underway to confirm the suspicion that it was killed by the H5 bird flu virus. 11:01. Lisette Mill is a vertebrate pest controller and biodiversity surveyor with Biodiversity Innovation AU. She says farmers will need to rethink some things, including how their dogs interact with wildlife like foxes.
This is a new game now, and dog, fox interactions are a potential pathway, canids to canids, for H5. But also, nobody who values their farm working dogs wants to see any of them impacted by this horrible disease or any of the others that foxes carry. So it's a good time to call up and go, okay, well, those things that maybe we didn't do before, now is the time we're going to do them. And that includes how you control your dogs, pets and working dogs in particular, and their ability to interact with a potentially H5-infected fox.
So if people are coming across a sick or dead fox on their property, should they be immediately keeping it in their mind that, I don't know how this fox has died, H5 is a possibility?
I believe so. I think that it's a legitimately good biosecurity thing to do. And there's a lot of aspects of foxes that, you know, should encourage people to take good biosecurity action already. But this is new. This has never come to Australia before. It's all new. So respond to the new and take that seriously.
Vertebrate pest controller and biodiversity surveyor Lisette Mill speaking to Selena Green. Livestock South Australia says there have been no detections of H5 bird flu in poultry or other livestock in South Australia, and transmission to sheep, cattle and goats in extensive production systems is considered unlikely. Producers should continue applying practical on-farm biosecurity measures, including limiting livestock contact with wild birds where possible, monitoring water and feed sources, ensuring staff and visitors follow biosecurity protocols, and promptly reporting unusual wildlife deaths or illness. 9 minutes to 1. The head of one of the country's largest chicken processors, Ingham's Group, is saying that they have not noticed a decline in sales since H5 bird flu was discovered in Australia. That's in contrast to what you heard on yesterday's show from some butchers in Western Australia who have noticed a significant decline in chicken meat sales. The owner of Meats and Mains in Perth, Tom Randolph, was saying that in the last 5 or 6 weeks, he'd noticed chicken meat sales have dropped by about 25%. And he suspects it's due to concerns over bird flu. Ingham's has just delivered its full year financial results, announcing a slump in annual profit on the back of soaring input costs. So as Emma Field explains, chicken prices are set to rise, even if they manage to avoid a bird flu outbreak.
Ingham's provide 40% of all the chicken we eat, but they have not been immune to cost blowouts. And as Chief Executive Officer of Ingham's Group, Edward Alexander, told an investor meeting, they are also worried about bird flu.
This is a real and a significant risk for the poultry industry. We take this risk extremely seriously and we are prepared for it. One of Ingham's fundamental strengths is the design of our network. We operate across multiple geographically separated regions with distinct clusters spanning feed mills, farming, hatcheries, processing facilities and distribution infrastructure. That means an outbreak in one location does not automatically translate into disruption across our broad network. We have the ability to isolate affected areas, protect other parts of the network and redirect production and supply. We've also invested considerable effort in prevention, surveillance, scenario planning and response protocols. Senior management have spent time in Europe understanding learnings from their experience. We can't fully eliminate the risk, but we can control how well prepared we are for it.
Across Europe, over 280 million birds have been culled as a result of the bird flu virus since 2021. In the US, 16 million broiler birds alone had to be culled, along with about 184 million other commercial birds, including egg-laying chickens. But Ingham says broiler chicken production is generally more protected from bird flu than egg production. And so far, fears of an outbreak hasn't affected the appetite for chicken.
We're not seeing any impact on demand at the moment. It's been well communicated that there's no food safety issue pertaining to bird flu, and we're not seeing that through any of our channels. You certainly see a greater impact across the egg producers, and I'd say, you know, one is simply the age of the birds. An older bird is slightly more susceptible to catching avian flu. And more generally speaking, there's a lower sort of biosecurity controls that can be in place across that industry. But yeah, we've certainly observed that across Europe as well.
The CEO was pressed on which Ingham's production region is the biggest and hence where an outbreak would have the biggest effect on chicken supply.
Our biggest sites are in Queensland and South Australia. Our next biggest site's Victoria, and then WA and Tasmania are smaller sites. The big ones are Queensland and South Australia. They're our two largest facilities. Assume bird flu does hit, it'll hit obviously one of our farms. So within a 2 kilometre radius, it's problematic. But then as long as you sort of depopulate within that zone, yeah, that's the kind of impacted portion of the population. So I kind of think about it as three layers. You go the geographic separation, then you go separation across farms, which again, I think we've designed our farms and our spreading of farms with biosecurity in mind. And then thirdly, it goes back to obviously the capability, expertise and ability of the business to respond.
So bird flu aside, the financial news Ingham delivered wasn't great. The company reported a 61.5% slump in net profit to $31 million for the year to June 30. The additional $13 million in costs linked to the Middle East conflict dampened the bottom line as a result.
Our two best months last year were February and March, ultimately, before the Middle East crisis hit.
And the company estimates it's facing an extra $50 million for soybean and wheat feed costs and $30 million more in transport and packaging costs. So that means chicken prices are likely to go up. And when he talks about wholesale buyers, it's the quick service restaurants or QSR like KFC and McDonald's, plus other food service distributors, while retailers include supermarkets like Woolworths and Coles.
Give or take $130 million of cost inflation driven by a combination of feed, Middle East, as well as embedded inflation. Even at the moment, it would affect broader chicken pricing. Wholesale will adjust because it's economics based and retail pricing moves more with changes to the cost base as opposed to supply-demand economics. With sort of our major, you know, retail and QSR customers as it relates to the passing through of feed costs in particular. And so we will see that take effect. But yeah, we need to work hard to continue offsetting cost.
Ingham's Group CEO, Edward Alexander there. And what about the rest of the industry and chicken processors? Are they worried about bird flu or rising costs? And will these costs be passed on to growers? Well, it's hard to know. The ABC contacted Baida, Hazeldine and Cordina, along with the Australian Chicken Meat Federation and Australian Chicken Growers Council. We either didn't hear back or they referred us to the Federal Department of Agriculture. In a statement, DAF says they are holding regular industry briefings to ensure the sector is up to date about the current detection of bird flu in wildlife. We liaise regularly with key organisations in the poultry supply chain, including the chicken broiler industry, and they provide information to the industry so businesses can make informed decisions on the risk of disease incursions on their premises, the DAF statement said.
Emma Field with that report. Ingham's is one of two companies that supply 70% of the chickens that are eaten in Australia. The other main company is Baida. 2 minutes to one to the markets now, and only 387 cattle were penned for sale at the Mount Barker market today. That's down 135 from last week's sale. Tracy Kilner, how were the prices today?
Limited numbers of trade weight cattle sold at similar values to last week, while the heavy yielding heifers gained 20 cents with feeder buyers chasing quality. A couple of processors operating on heavy cows and bulls saw cows remain firm, while the bulls eased 5 cents with a heavier lineup from last week. The weaner steers weighing over 330 kilos sold at 532 cents. Weights over 280 kilos returned 460 to 540, and the lightweights made from 474 to 552 cents a kilo. Weaned heifers weighing over 330 kilos sold for 508 cents, while the lightweights returned 430 to 486 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold to feeder buyers from 476 to 548 cents, and yearling heifers returned 440 to 514 cents. Grown steers weighing between 500 and 600 kilos sold from 442 to 470 cents, while the heavy bullocks returned 370 to 470 cents a kilo. Heavyweight cows sold from 308 to 350 cents, and the store cows made from 270 to 292 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls sold from 284 to 352 cents, and lighter weights returned 330 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Tracy. Earlier we heard from former Dongara-based fisher James Oliver, who leased his fishing units and so therefore won't get any compensation from the state government. Stephen Busso says, what a great interview with the young bloke from Dongara. He had compassion for his investors, competition and others in the industry, just the sort of things that the WA government doesn't have. Good to talk to you. Time for the news. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.